Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's show, we explore the measles outbreak running rampant in this country and what you need to know.
This is a serious illness that deserves a swift response to. We have effective tool, and it's the vaccine.
Plus, we talk about removing the stigma of mental illness in our schools.
If there's anything that's different about you that keeps you from being accepted, you're going to find different outlets: drug abuse, internalizing behavior, introversion, and so on. And those things, that type of isolation is not healthy.
And dealing with that annoying yet sometimes frightening problem, nosebleeds.
If it's a severe nosebleed, it's not getting under control in 15 to 20 minutes, I would go to your local emergency department.
We'll learn more about snacking healthy and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore the measles outbreak running rampant in this country and what you need to know. Plus, nosebleeds, they can be annoying and sometimes frightening, so what should you do about them? But first, mental illness carries with it a strong societal and cultural stigma that leads to serious consequences. We'll examine some local efforts to combat these through understanding and tolerance. According to a study by Harvard Medical School, over 25% of adults suffer from mental disorders, and half of all lifetime cases of mental illness begin by age 14. Thus, mental illness is a real issue facing many of today's youth. In the U.S. alone, approximately 5 million children have some type of serious mental illness. But unfortunately, only 20% of those affected youth are identified and receive the mental health services they need. Well, some of that has to do with lack of resources, but much of it also has to do with the stigma associated with it. Joining me to shed some light on one way to help destigmatize mental illness is Dr. Stephen Glatt. He's the director of the Psychiatric Genetic Epidemiology and Neurobiology Lab at Upstate Medical University. And joining him is Andy Beltran. He's a fourth-year medical student at Upstate Medical University as well. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
So, Dr. Glatt, the stigma of mental illness is a real problem. Help us understand that.
It's one of the biggest problems. So having a mental illness is really tough. And what makes it even tougher to be successful, to have a functional, normal life when you're dealing with a mental illness, is the sense of isolation, the sense of being different, the sense of being unwanted or unwelcome. That's the stigma, is that people perceive that you're abnormal and you don't belong.
And it seems like that presents tremendous barriers, as I alluded to in the introduction, to getting help of any kind.
That's right. Our community perpetuates this idea about mental illness being a bad or an evil thing. And because of that, when someone starts to experience symptoms that are treatable, the shame and the desire to hide that from everyone else keeps them from seeking out that treatment.
Why do you think that our culture seems to have this kind of bias against diseases of the mind versus diseases of the body?
It's true. I think, you know, there's no such bias against cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, and so on. I think it's because the mind in and of itself is so complex, and we can't pinpoint the root causes. So people incorrectly assume that if someone has a personality disorder, it's their choice. And it's not their choice. We've shown through decades of research that these are biological brain disorders, much of the time having both genetic and environmental contributions, but certainly not the choice of the individual. I think that's the big bias.
And Andy, you've been involved in this program. We're going to talk about this program to try to destigmatize these, especially to help young children or young people understand the power of the stigma. What do you see as the consequences of having that kind of stigma? I mean, how does it play out in a young child or a young adult when they feel the stigma?
I think Dr. Glatt mentioned it as well, that they become very isolated. They don't know who to turn to. And even when they turn to their parents, it's very difficult for a parent to help their children out because they also feel the isolation. And it's difficult for the whole family to seek help.
And I think the rates of things like teen suicide, bullying, hazing, all of those kinds of things reflect often the case where someone's suffering from some kind of a mental illness.
That's right. If there's anything that's different about you that keeps you from being accepted, you're going to find different outlets, drug abuse, internalizing behavior, introversion, and so on. And those things, that type of isolation is not healthy.
So you, Dr. Glatt, you've been involved in an organization, NAMI. Tell us about that organization. What have you been doing with them and why?
Well, I've been involved with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Syracuse chapter, for many years. Some of my research was in the newspaper, and a stakeholder in the community, Betty Pringle, who founded NAMI Syracuse chapter, reached out to me. And through her, it finally put a face on mental illness because of her own family that was affected and the people I met through her at NAMI. It finally connected for me that I'm not just doing research in the ivory tower. It has an effect. It gives people hope. So I joined NAMI and I got on their board. And one of the things, having young children myself, that I thought I could help with was getting into the school systems to educate children who currently aren't learning about mental illness and stigma and so on, teaching them the facts about brain disorders.
I mean, it's a large mountain to climb, or a hurdle to overcome, it seems to me, that when the culture is so negative. But you have to start somewhere.
And you have to start early. So if we were going out and trying to talk to parents, it would be like beating our head against the wall. Mm-hmm. Their ideas are already entrenched. The children, they're willing to listen. They're willing to learn. And if we teach the children, they'll become more empathic adults whose own children will learn from them, maybe not necessarily from us. They'll come to school already equipped with an understanding of mental illness.
It's a wonderful goal. So what do you think then, in a general sense, what do you think needs to be done? Andy, what needs to be done? Before we get into the specifics of your program, what generally needs to be done to change the hearts and minds?
I think starting early is the goal. Starting to definitely focus very early age so that people feel that they can share their stories, they can talk to their friends, talk to their family, to make it acceptable. One of the things that I've seen, especially when I interact with these children, is that they themselves don't feel like they can share their stories. So starting early on to allowing them to share their stories.
So acceptance, tolerance, that kind of thing needs to be kind of promoted very young.
And also a grounding in the facts. You know, it's not just our opinion. These are facts that these are biological brain disorders. There's treatments that work. And if you seek out help, you will get better.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with research psychologist Dr. Stephen Glatt and medical student Andy Beltran. We're talking about the stigma attached to mental illness and what can be done about it. So you've launched a program through NAMI, I guess?
It is. It's a NAMI program. I can't take credit for creating it, but we take credit, and especially I give a lot of credit to Andy for really disseminating this in our community. It's called Breaking the Silence, and it's a teacher-developed curriculum developed in NAMI Nassau and Queens branch that has spread throughout the country. They're using this in Iowa and California. We're using this in as many school districts as we can in Onondaga County with this help and support of OnCare, and we're trying to get this curriculum starting at fourth grade all the way through high school into health classes, science classes, or the basic curriculum of the public schools.
So how does it work? I mean, tell us about that, Andy. How does it actually work? Do you work alongside a teacher? Is the teacher given the curriculum? I mean, what actually takes place?
Well, the goal is that we would reach out to the schools and specifically the health teachers and provide the learning packets to them so that they themselves can go over the material and select different lesson plans to teach their students. It's a self-contained packet that should be easily implemented into their classroom. But there are times when teachers don't feel comfortable, and there are times when I've actually gone in myself and taught 45 minutes to an hour.
Wow.
if needed. And I think that gives them the confidence to actually start teaching themselves.
Wow.
So
you've jump-started it at times.
At times I have jump-started it, but the goal is, because I guess as medical students we're so busy, is to actually have the teachers themselves. It's a very, very basic. You know, we're teaching. It's not. We're not trying to make students into psychologists, psychiatrists. It's very, very basic, and anybody who takes half an hour to read over it can pretty much implement it in the classroom.
So, what grades are you targeting again, specifically?
Starting from fourth grade all the way through high school, 12th grade.
And have you? What's been the response from the schools, the school districts? And this is mostly local, am I correct?
This is all of Onondaga County that we're reaching out to. So far, we've only reached out to schools in the vicinity, like Liverpool, East Syracuse, and Skaneateles. The response is great. I think especially when I actually go and do the teaching, I can see the response firsthand, and people are very receptive. The students themselves, you know, at the end of, after I finished teaching, I asked them, is this something you would want to learn in school? Is this really, and everybody agrees that yes, I would love to learn this in school. I wish it would start earlier. So it's been, even the students themselves are very receptive.
How do you find time for this, Andy?
there have been times when I don't have time, so it's been very difficult to find time. I usually, you know, squeeze it in between, I guess, rotations, because right now I'm a fourth year and I'm doing rotations. I squeeze it in between rotations. I also have a lot of help. There are students who have actually volunteered their time as well, who come with me to help teach, and also who all reach out to the schools themselves.
So, Dr. Glatt, what do you think your goal, I mean, what do you see as the end product of this in a perfect world? What would happen?
In our perfect corner of the world being, let's say, greater Onondaga County, a perfect world for me is where every school district, grade four and beyond, is getting exposed to the Breaking Silence curriculum at least once a year. Maybe in October when it's Mental Health Awareness Month, maybe in May when there's another week dedicated to mental health. At least once a year, they should be being reminded of this material. There is research that shows that implementing this Breaking the Silence curriculum in the middle schools changes children's knowledge, it changes their attitudes, and it changes their behaviors toward people with mental illness. But whether or not that's lasting, we're not sure, because that was a one-time trial. But it makes sense that if kids are exposed to this curriculum every year at advancing levels, they'll grow up to be very empathic, knowledgeable adults with regard to mental illness. So in our perfect world, we'd have this in every district.
So you see this happening now in other places within the country as well. As you mentioned, NAMI is doing this elsewhere. Has there been any research, or is there any data to support what are the outcomes so far?
As I said, there's just been this one research study that showed that 6 weeks after middle schoolers were exposed to the curriculum, it increased their knowledge of the facts about mental illness. It increased their attitudes. It improved their attitudes toward mental illness. For example, if they were asked a question about, would you be willing to sit next to someone at lunch who has a mental illness? Before the testing, maybe 40% of kids said yes. After the testing, it's maybe 80%. So social distance decreases between a child who's educated and someone with a mental illness.
It seems to me also that it could have ramifications beyond this particular message, in the sense that the larger message is one of tolerance.
That's right.
And compassion. And those two messages really go way beyond just the mental illness issue.
Correct. I completely agree. I think as the more and more I do this, the more and more I realize that it's not just about mental illness. It's about compassion. It's about acceptance. It's about getting others to allow them to develop as human beings.
And we hear from health teachers, it's very difficult to add new things to their curriculum. They have mandates from New York State that they have to teach such and such. Well, one of the things they have to teach about is bullying. Another is drug abuse. Mental illness ties into these topics very closely.
Absolutely.
So we try to appeal to them that don't see this as something new you have to add. See this as something that supplements and is real world relevant for the kids when you're talking about bullying. Why do kids get bullied? Because they're different. Maybe they have symptoms of a mental illness. It dovetails nicely with those mandates.
Absolutely. So where do you see the future of this particular program going locally?
Well, I think when I started doing this, we had the curriculum in maybe 5 to 6 schools. When Andy came on board, we went up exponentially. We're at about 30 schools doing this now. And the team that Andy's firsthand recruited of other Upstate Medical University medical students who want to do this, I think within a couple years, we could have every district in the county administering
wow.
the curriculum.
Amazing. You're looking for some people to get involved as well and more information? How would they do that?
Well, we're really appealing to the parents of children who think that this is important for their children to be learning in the schools. We're also appealing to educators or people who work in the school systems. Let's get this curriculum into your school district if it's not using it already. They can contact us at NAMI Syracuse offices, namisyracuse.org, and we'll be happy to speak with them, come meet with them, and even administer the curriculum ourselves if need be. But we really do want to train people to administer this curriculum in their school districts.
Wonderful work. Thank you so much for sharing it. I wish you all the best. It's great. Very inspiring.
Thank you for my the guests opportunity.
My guests have been Dr. Stephen Glad. He's the director of the Psychiatric Genetic Epidemiology and Neurobiology Lab at Upstate Medical University, and Andy Beltran, a fourth-year medical student at Upstate Medical University and a volunteer for this program. Once again, thanks so much for coming in. Next up, the measles outbreak, what you need to know. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Health officials reported earlier this week that there are now over 100 confirmed measles cases as part of the new current outbreak. And according to the California Department of Public Health's website, many of those cases are linked to an outbreak at Disneyland. Of note is that also many of these cases were among adults. But the big news is it's spreading from state to state. Here to help me with understand this outbreak and the danger it poses is Dr. Yana Shaw, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, specializing in infectious disease at the Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Shaw. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, Linda.
Everybody's mind. Everybody's talking about this today because I think people haven't realized that measles still exists. It's a serious disease, and it's spreading. What exactly For people who are just listening and don't really know what the measles are, tell us what it is.
Measles is a viral illness, hence antibiotics will not work for it. It's in general been considered a childhood disease before we had an effective vaccine. The illness itself starts with a runny nose and cough and itchy, red, or watery eyes. So it can look just as a cold or a flu. The children who will continue with symptoms will develop rash, and the rash usually starts at the head and spreads down to their toes.
So there's a pattern to the way the rash progresses. And what does it look like? Is it characteristic in some way?
Yes, the rash is very characteristic for measles. However, a number of younger doctors may not be familiar with the rash as they have not seen measles since we've had such an effective vaccine. So the rash can be slightly itchy. It's red. It's characteristic for measles.
And it's basically, are there other symptoms that go along with it? Is high fever, mild to moderate fever?
Yes, the fever actually can be very high, and it's not uncommon for measles to give children fever up to 103, 105 degrees Fahrenheit.
When we talk about how serious it is, you know, there's been a lot bandied about in the press that this is a really serious disease. I mean, what's the mortality rate generally from this disease?
So in general, people believe that measles are a mild illness. However, we know that the severity is quite high. 1 to 3 children or people who were infected with measles out of 1,000 would die from measles. And severe complications such as pneumonia or brain swelling and brain damage have occurred in a similar number of patients. So measles is not a condition that should be or illness that should be taken lightly, and certainly is not one that I would want my children or my patients to be exposed to.
It's interesting because in my own personal experience, this will give away my age, I had the measles,
yes.
And so did all of my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was routine as we were growing up to expect to get the measles,
yeah,
amongst other diseases. We did not have vaccines at,
mm-hmm,
that time. So fortunately, I was able to have the measles and survive it, as were my siblings. But clearly, there are enough cases where children really can perish as a result of this disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Worldwide, thousands of children die of measles. The deaths have been eliminated in countries that have universal measles vaccination programs in place. So this is a serious illness that deserves swift response to, and we have effective tool, and it's a vaccine.
You know, once it was eradicated in this country, as you said, for the last 10 years or so, for the most part, we were not seeing measles in this country. However, in the last 3 or 4 years, there have been these measles outbreaks. What's the thought behind why this is happening now, or why were we able to eradicate it? It's even the better question.
Yeah, so in the U.S. since 2000, the measles were declared to be eliminated, which means there was no within the country continuous transmission of measles. However, we have seen measles outbreaks, as you pointed out, in communities or among people who were not vaccinated. So measles in the U.S. are associated with importation from other countries.
Either somebody coming in who's contracted elsewhere.
Elsewhere, and then transmits the infection among vulnerable people who have not been vaccinated.
So that's mainly the source at this point of these outbreaks that have taken place. But this is a pretty significant one taking place right now.
Correct.
In terms of the numbers alone, yes, and the number of states involved.
Yes. And, you know, I think last year we had one of the largest measles outbreaks since 2000. It was in the Ohio Amish community. There were hundreds of people who got infected, but we were able successfully to control it with CDC very active immunization program that was implemented in that community. This time, the measles outbreaks started in Disneyland, where people gather and travel in and out in large numbers. And as the outbreak tracker indicates, the outbreak has been spreading into multiple states. The reason being is because measles are extremely contagious illness.
That was going to be my next question. So tell us, how is it spread?
It is spread through through droplets. The problem with measles is that the infected particles can remain in the room for up to 2 hours. So even if the infected person has left the room, you can still get infected by touching infected surfaces.
So it's highly, highly contagious.
Very contagious, similar to tuberculosis or smallpox.
And unlike something like Ebola, which caused a great furor in this country but requires a great deal more exposure to bodily fluids, this is literally air transmission, and the droplets can just remain in the air for hours.
Quite.
So it's quite... And how long is it communicable, meaning... I read somewhere that it has an 8-day range, and sometimes it's actually communicable by the patient long before the rash shows up.
That's correct. So that's the other confusing part about measles, that you can be infectious, contagious 4 days before you develop the rash and continue to be infectious 4 days after the rash has disappeared. So the period of communicability is pretty long.
And that also makes it, in a sense, so much more contagious, because unknowingly someone could mm-hmm. maybe just feel a little ill, have no rash, travel, and expose countless others to that problem.
That's correct.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with infectious disease pediatrician Dr. Yana Shaw. We're talking about the recent outbreak of measles and what to do about it. So basically you're saying that the reason we are currently experiencing the degree of outbreak, or even in the past, has to do with lack of vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people have not been sufficiently immunized, and that's been a function of choice. But take us back very briefly in the history. For example, I know that there was that article written, I don't know, many years ago now, 10, 15 years ago, by Dr. Wakefield in mm-hmm. The Lancet, that somehow linked mm-hmm. the MMR vaccine to autism. Is that correct?
That's correct. Unfortunately, that article has spurred growth of anti-vaccination movement. The article has since been debunked. The physician has lost his license to practice in England.
He falsified data.
Correct.
There was
a corrupted paper.
Right.
However, the people who still worry about dangers of vaccination continue to refer to that original article. And we have not been very successful about changing their minds about the safety and effectiveness of measles vaccine.
And all of the data and all of the scientific research to date, which has been redone in order to try to refute this article, has supported the notion that the vaccine is safe and effective, both.
That's correct.
So what is the current recommendation right now for children and adults with regard to the measles vaccination?
Currently, it's recommended that children 12 to 15 months of age and 4 to 6 years of age receive a dose of MMR vaccine. Also, adults who have not been vaccinated and were born 1957 or later should receive at least one dose of MMR vaccine. If you're a student in college or you work in healthcare facility, you should receive two doses.
Now, the reason why people of 1957, born before 1957, do not need vaccination is that?
Because they were very likely infected during the natural disease that we have seen in the United States circulating.
And then they, therefore, like myself, would theoretically have lifelong immunity.
Correct.
So your immunity won't fade necessarily if you've experienced the disease.
In general, if you had a natural infection, we believe you are immune. However, there are some other conditions that can weaken your immune system. So even if you had measles as a young adult and you develop lupus and take medications that suppress your immune system, then you might again be vulnerable.
And in that case, you might consider it. Just so if you're immunosuppressed specifically. So basically, at this point, is it required in New York State? I want to get into this a little bit, this whole concept of this refusal to vaccinate your children. I know it's been talked about a lot in the news, but do we have mandatory laws right now in New York State that our children are vaccinated?
Yes. So the New York State had a school immunizations laws. They are public health laws that require that children who enter school are properly vaccinated. And measles, mumps, rubella is one of those vaccines that's required for school entry. However, the law does allow certain children to be exempted for medical or religious reasons.
So we do still have the loophole, so to speak, of those people who can opt out or choose not to vaccinate their children. The question's been raised, and I'm just curious, this is an opinion I'm asking you for. The question's been raised, should those parents who choose not to vaccinate their children be held in some way accountable or liable to the general public? Because in effect, they are putting many others at risk.
That's correct. It is my personal opinion that there should be some kind of accountability for their choices. And people should be free to express their beliefs and exercise their beliefs. However, I don't think that their beliefs, that doesn't protect them from being accountable. If their beliefs put others in danger, they should be financially, morally held accountable. Outbreaks are extremely expensive to investigate. Children who end up in the hospital because they got measles, the cost of the bill for those parents who vaccinated or could not vaccinate their children are tremendous.
And the children who are most at risk are those infants, for example, who have not yet achieved an age where they can be vaccinated.
That's right. Or there are people who cannot be vaccinated because they have cancer, for example. So I do
think... Are most vulnerable.
They are most vulnerable.
Right. So go ahead. You were going to say you do think it's something that...
That should be thought about, and there should be some processes in place that will allow families who are affected by people who make their choice not to vaccinate and are harmed by choice, that they recoup some of the cost that they've associated with that decision.
It's a very, very difficult conversation. It's going on in this country and probably needs to be. The whole idea of the personal rights and individual freedom versus the public good. Mm-hmm. And you can see why that is a slippery slope and a difficult discussion. But in these circumstances where it's becoming so apparent that we're putting a lot of very vulnerable individuals at risk, I think it's something that really needs to be addressed, really on the federal level. And the president himself has said, get your children vaccinated.
Yeah.
So I know other politicians are weighing in on this. I don't even want to go there because it's not worthy of our conversation. But very briefly, are there cases in Central New York?
There were no cases in Central New York. There are three cases reported in New York State.
So we have to be on the lookout. And what should you do if you hear of any cases in your area as a parent? Or how would you protect yourself and your family, basically, at this moment?
Make sure your immunization is up to date, that you have received MMR vaccine, and make sure your children are vaccinated. And if you know of somebody who is ill, maybe stay away from them.
All right. Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Yana Shaw. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, specializing in infectious diseases at the Golisano Children's Hospital. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi. This is Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian with this week's segment of Healthy Eats. Let's talk about snacking. The key to healthier snacking is portion control, choosing nutrient-dense snacks, and fitting snacks into your overall nutrition plan. Here are some tips to help you. Plan ahead. Prepare your snacks in advance. Have fruits and vegetables available and ready to go. Make a list of the healthy snacks you like. Shop accordingly, and then have them prepared ahead. Have fruit measured out in portable serving containers. Have vegetables cleaned and cut into bite-sized pieces. Practice portion control. Use small containers, small snack bags. Avoid eating out of the box or bag. Use your measuring cups. See what 1/4 cup of nuts really looks like. Tune into your body's signals. Are you really hungry? Is it habit? Is it a response to stress, boredom, anger? Rate your hunger level. Are you thirsty? Do you really need a glass of water instead? Think about where you are snacking. Is it in front of the TV, in your favorite chair, or is it at the computer? Do you snack alone or with someone? Think about the timing of your snacks. If you finish dinner at 7, are you really hungry for a snack at 8:15? Got a craving for something crunchy? Try Air Pop popcorn or low-fat popcorn with a dash of Parmesan cheese or an herb seasoning on it. Nuts can satisfy your crunch craving, but be aware of the amount. I tell clients, a handful, not a canful. Looking for a sweet snack? Here are a few ideas. Dip fresh berries or apple slice in yogurt flavored with cinnamon or nutmeg. Or try frozen grapes, my favorite. They can be cold, crunchy, and so refreshing. You can also peel a small banana, dip it in yogurt, freeze it, and then enjoy a few slices at a time. If you opt to use packaged snacks, be aware of the serving sizes in the package and see how it relates to what you eat. Read the label. Added sugars, fats, saturated fats can sneak into your diet if you're not careful. Practice mindful snacking. Slow down. Enjoy your food. Chew your food. Savor the taste, the texture, and the flavor of that snack. Snacks can be a healthy part of your nutrition plan. Careful planning is the key. This has been Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian with your serving of Healthy Eats.
Next, those annoying and sometimes frightening nosebleeds. What do you need to do? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of February 8th. Start slow, go steady. Physical activity isn't just a way to lose weight, it's an essential step towards a long and vibrant life. If you haven't been active in a while, now's the time to revamp your routine. Start out with smaller amounts of exercise at lower intensities and gradually progress to moderate intensity activity to reduce your risk of injury. This week, work on your fitness routine and don't worry about how fast or hard others are exercising around you. Remember that you're never too out of shape to get active. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Nosebleeds are usually not dangerous, but because they can occur quite suddenly and with what can seem like quarts of blood gushing from your nose, they can be quite scary. Well, here with more on the proper and most effective treatments for this very common problem is Dr. Jennifer Vilwack. She's a senior resident in the Department of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Vilwack. Thanks for coming in.
Yep, thanks for having me.
So help us understand first, when we say nosebleeds, they're also medically known, I guess, as epistaxis. What exactly is happening?
Yeah, so essentially, you know, it's a very common problem, as you did mention. And essentially what's happening is there's bleeding from one of the multiple vessels that are in the nose. The nose has one of the most extensive, you know, vascular networks in the body. So essentially any of those very little tiny vessels to larger vessels could suddenly start bleeding. And there's a variety of different reasons why that might happen.
And is it important where in the nose that occurs? I mean, in terms of the severity of the problem? In other words, if it happens in the front, is it less severe than if it happens in the back?
Yep, absolutely. So the most common nosebleeds are starting in the front or anterior in the nose. And those are by far the majority of nosebleeds. Those tend to be less severe, and a lot of times they'll respond to just if you hold your nose tightly and apply some pressure. There's a subset of nosebleeds that are further back in the nose, and those tend to be more severe. They tend to be from larger vessels, and as you can imagine, they're a little bit harder to get to. You can't really apply pressure in the back of your nose as you can for those little bleeders in the front.
How common are they, and when, you know, what percentage, for example, might require some help?
Mm-hmm. So nosebleeds are pretty common. Overall, in the literature, they say that approximately 60% of the U.S. population will experience a nosebleed of some sort. But I think almost virtually everybody has experienced, you know, a couple of drops of blood from the nose, whether it's, you know, after getting hit in the face or blowing your nose too much after a cold or a respiratory tract infection. Of those 60% that have, you know, more significant nosebleeds that they're reporting to their physicians, about 6% of those will actually go on to require more intervention and need to present to a medical professional.
We're going to get to talking about how you know the difference, but what I'm curious about now is what are the causes generally when mm-hmm. you look at, you know, I mean, you mentioned getting hit in the nose. I mean, that's quite obvious. But what are some of the other causes that lead to nosebleeds in people?
Well, certainly at this time of year when, you know, the heater is running because it's cold outside, that cold, dry air and then also the warm, dry air when you make your transition from outside to inside is very drying on the nose. And a lot of those vessels that I mentioned can be very superficial. And so just that extra drying can cause some irritation of the mucosa or the lining over top of those vessels. And once that erodes through or gets irritated, you can have bleeding there.
So does it require some trauma, like, I hate to be so overt about it, but picking your nose, for example, does it require some physical trauma to actually make it bleed, or can it just spontaneously start to bleed?
It can just spontaneously start bleeding, and I suspect a lot of that is because, you know, you might not be aware of the minor trauma that might have caused the nosebleed. For example, if you're just rubbing your nose or if you're blowing your nose quite frequently, it doesn't seem like that's obvious trauma to you, but, you know, to those delicate tissues on the inside of the nose, it can be enough to start a nosebleed. And certainly things like manipulation in the nose, whether it's, you know, with your finger picking your nose, or, you know, folks that have to wear an nasal cannula for oxygen delivery at home, those things can be very irritating to the nose as well.
Right. Who's most at risk for this? I mean, do we see it across the population, or are there certain age groups that are more or less at risk?
Yeah. There's a certain group of children that just for, you know, unknown reasons do have a lot of issues with nose bleeding. They tend to outgrow that as they get older. In the population that we see presenting to the hospital, I would say the most salient risk factor is anticoagulation. So folks that are on medications to thin the blood. So examples of that would be aspirin, warfarin or Coumadin, Plavix, and then even herbal or alternative remedies such as fish oil also have a blood thinning effect. So that can kind of predispose you to have a nosebleed, because once it starts, your blood's not going to be as apt to clot. So you can have a longer or more severe nosebleed from those things.
How about just generally having colds or allergies? In other words, people who may be more allergic, are they generally more susceptible to something like a nosebleed?
Yeah, they're also more susceptible just because there's more constant irritation to that mucosa or that covering over the blood vessels. And there tends to be, again, more manipulation of that area as you're blowing your nose or trying other things to help with whatever congestion or other symptoms you're having.
Are there any anatomical things that lead to it? I mean, I remember as a kid people saying, well, he has a deviated septum kind of thing, either because they were born that way or they had an injury in soccer or something of that nature. I mean, are there anatomical things that also make you more apt to experience nosebleeds?
Yep, absolutely. And as you mentioned, septal deviations are one thing that make you more apt. And the main theory behind why that is just there's more turbulent airflow. So again, more likely to have kind of trauma from the airflow.
Oh, I see.
And there's also septal perforations or a hole in the septum also predisposes you to have nosebleeds as well. And a lot of times we'll see people in the emergency room who have a nosebleed and we'll comment, you know, we see that there's a hole in your septum, and that might be the first time that they're even noting that they have a hole there is because they have the epistaxis or the nosebleed, which leads them to get medical intervention.
How about things like smoking or being exposed to smoke, either secondhand or yourself? Mm-hmm. Does that raise the incidence?
Yep. Also? And again, it just goes back to anything that's going to be irritating for the nasal mucosa is going to put you more at risk to have a nosebleed. And certainly there's a host of things in cigarette smoke and secondhand smoke that are going to irritate that area.
So in general, they're not serious.
Correct.
and they're quite common, as you've said, and we've both talked about. But can they ever be more serious?
Yes. So as we mentioned earlier, there's kind of the nosebleeds that start more in the front of the nose, which generally if you spray some Afrin or nasal decongestant that help constrict the blood vessels and hold pressure, those will stop. But the nosebleeds that are more posterior are more of a problem, A, because it's harder to see them and apply the pressure that might help them to stop, and B, because they can be from larger vessels in that area that just you're not going to be able to stop with things like pressure.
Do they also occur because of some a more serious underlying problem at that point?
Not always. You know, there's a subset of patients that have scary things that are causing their nosebleeds, such as tumors, you know, further back in the nose, and those can bleed quite briskly. But for a lot of people, it's what we call idiopathic. We just don't really have a clear reason as to why that would start. And, you know, again, if they have other medical conditions, you know, making them be on blood thinners or uncontrolled high blood pressure, those things can kind of facilitate the nosebleed. But for a lot of patients, we just don't have a great explanation of why it starts.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Jennifer Vilwalk, and we're talking about nosebleeds, why they occur, and how best to treat them. Can they ever be life-threatening, I guess, is the question. Let's say you're on a blood thinner. If you can't stop the bleeding, can it ever be life-threatening?
Yes, they certainly can be life-threatening bleeding levels. And so the way that you would kind of tell is, you know, if it's to the point where you're holding your nose in the front and it's bleeding through your mouth, you know, quite briskly.
Down the back of your throat,
yeah, because the back of your nose and your throat are connected, then that's kind of an indicator that it's getting to be very serious. And for some folks, it's almost as if you've turned a faucet on, you know, and it's just there's nothing that you can do to stop the flow of the blood.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what kind of medical intervention and how to get them, but let's just generally say in the most general common garden variety nosebleed, what should you do?
So the first thing to do is just to hold pressure. And some people like to use things like clothespins or other things just to make it easier for themselves. My recommendation would just be to use, you know, your thumb and your index finger and hold pressure in the front of the nose, kind of pinching off the nostrils. And to do that for about 15 to 20 minutes. So not
that
just
long.
Yeah, so not just a couple of minutes. I mean, just really crank down on that area for 15 minutes or so. If you have things on hand at home like oxymetazoline, the trade name for that is Afrin. It's available over the counter. That spray is a topical decongestant and a vasoconstrictor, so it'll help kind of shrink the vessels that are bleeding, and that can also be very helpful in stopping the nosebleed.
Should you ever do what I remember seeing people do when I was young, basically stuff the nose with tissue paper or, you know, toilet paper or something, you know, like that to try to block it up? Is that a wise thing to do or not?
I wouldn't necessarily recommend that. A, because you're initiating more trauma into that area just by inserting the tissues, and B, you know, the tissue is there to help absorb the blood, but also, you know, hopefully maybe blocking off what's bleeding. But ultimately, just that little bit of pressure from the tissue isn't going to work as well as if you're holding pressure with your fingers.
How about head position? I mean, I've heard things like keep your head back, keep your head forward. What's the right head position.
Yeah, in general, we recommend that you keep your head in a very neutral position. The reason being, if you're tilting your head forward, then now you have gravity kind of helping the blood to keep coming out. And if you tilt your head back, again, as we mentioned, the back of the nose and the throat is connected, and there's actually quite a bit of space back there. So if your head is tilted back, the blood's going to start pooling, you know, if it's still bleeding in the back of the nose, you can get big clots that then are problematic, and that you'll have blood kind of running down the back of your throat, which becomes a little bit more distressing for the person who's having the nosebleed as well.
How about things like ice?
Ice is also a good option. You know, certainly you wouldn't put the ice inside the nose, but you can, you know, put ice kind of over the nasal bridge or the top of the nose. And again, it works in a similar way as the decongestant, you know, just
as the Afrin to help constrict the blood vessels.
The blood vessels.
So the basic point is you're trying to help the blood stop by constriction of the blood vessels and then the natural clotting.
Correct.
That would take place, but you have to help it along mechanically in some way or chemically or in the case of temperature.
Right, absolutely.
So when and how do you know? I mean, this may seem self-evident, but when and how do you know that this is more serious and you're going to need some help?
Mm-hmm. So one way is, you know, if you're having just a lot of bleeding. You know, you're holding pressure, your head's in a neutral position, and the blood is just still coming. It's coming out your mouth. You know, you're just having bleeding above and beyond, you know, what any person would think is normal. If you're holding pressure for that 15 to 20 minutes, and as soon as you release, it starts bleeding again, that would also be an indicator that you should come in and get some help, because it's unlikely to stop on its own at that point in time.
So what would you then recommend? I mean, people should go to an emergency department?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can certainly either go to an urgent care or an emergency department, and at that point, they'll be able to try additional things. For those bleeds that happen in the very front of the nose, sometimes we can see the prominent blood vessels that are actually bleeding, and at that point, we can apply cautery directly to that area.
Just heat to actually seal it off.
Yeah, usually what we initially do will be chemical cautery with a silver nitrate stick. So it works similar to the heat cautery, same kind of principle. Is using either heat or chemicals to shrink those blood vessels down so they stop bleeding.
What other types of techniques might you need to use?
So usually when we have a patient that we see in our emergency department here at Upstate, we will do a nasal endoscopy, meaning we'll look into the nose with a little camera. That way we can better see and visualize the site of bleeding. Again, if it's very small and not bleeding too briskly, we can use that silver nitrate. There's other special chemicals that you can use. One is thrombin that's kind of on a foam matrix. And so the thrombin is essentially a chemical in the blood that helps things clot. So we can apply that directly to the area that's bleeding.
You did some research where you looked at, I guess, a certain number of cases and the types of intervention that were done with regard to nosebleeds. What'd you find?
Yeah, so essentially we found that, you know, the vast majority of folks are either being treated conservatively, meaning sprays with the Afrin, you know, holding pressure, that there's another subset of folks that are actually going to the operating room or going to the interventional radiology suite to either have ligation or clipping or cutting of the arteries that are bleeding or having, you know, a different substance infused.
That's a much smaller number.
Yeah, that's a much smaller number.
And what was the bottom line? Was it that early treatment really solved the problem?
Yeah, so in the people that have nosebleeds severe enough to warrant admission to the hospital, early treatment within the first 24 hours, you know, helps in terms of the overall length of stay and cost associated with that hospitalization, just because if you have such a severe nosebleed, it's unlikely to stop on its own.
So what's the bottom line for parents or anyone listening if they have a kid who may, I mean, children do tend to grow out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the bottom line?
So the bottom line is, you know, if it's a severe nosebleed, it's not getting under control in 15 to 20 minutes, I would go to your local emergency department. Things that you can try at home are things like just holding pressure. If you have that oxymetazoline or Afrin nasal spray that you can apply, ice to the bridge of the nose, all of those things are very helpful. But ultimately, if it's a very severe nosebleed or if it's a nosebleed that's occurring, you know, every couple of days, you know, it gets under control, but it's a persistent problem. At that point, you don't have to go to the emergency room necessarily, but I would seek additional care to see if, you know, there's a little vessel that we could cauterize or if further treatment is needed so it's not an ongoing problem.
Well, that's very wonderful and helpful advice. Thanks very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Jennifer Vilwalk. She's a senior resident in the Department of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Memory can sometimes cushion the blow of present-day reality. Sometimes memory can exacerbate that pain. In her beautiful poem of reminiscence called The Grape Arbor, Maryland poet Dottie Holcomb Doherty does both. The Grape Arbor. The lichen-laced arbor stands silent as I untwist its vine, a weather-beaten muscle of wood, barren these last 2 years after flourishing for 60. When daring each other, my sister and I bit into the tart nubs of early grapes. Then, as clusters ripened, we popped their purpleness into our mouths, chewed the thick, sweet skins, cringed at the sour centers, spat the bumpy seeds. When summer waned and nights cooled, we picked until bushel baskets overflowed. Separated from stems, crushed, heated, poured into the large stained cheesecloth bag to hang overnight above the stainless steel kettle, the Concord grapes dripped their midnight purple juice. Next morning, adding sugar and pectin, Mom boiled the nectar, skimmed the lavender-colored foam, poured the fragrant liquid into hot half-pint jars, layered each with melted paraffin to seal them tight. The vine crumbles in my hands. Only a few wax-topped jars of jelly remain in the cool dark of Mom's cellar. We break the seal. Eat it carefully now. Its sweetness almost too much to bear.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the emotional concerns that come with prostate cancer. Plus, what exactly is Legionnaire's disease, and are you at risk for it? If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.